This podcast provides audio versions of live webinars. Please see the episode description for a link to the full presentation.
Welcome to Listen In, a Bite-Sized Bio podcast series allowing you to access the best of Bite-Sized Bio webinars wherever you are.
Hello, this is Ava Amson, welcoming you to this Bite-Sized Bio webinar, which today is sponsored by Thermo Fisher. Thermo Fisher Scientific is the world leader in serving science with a mission to enable their customers to make the world healthier, cleaner, and safer. Thermo Fisher serves both academic and industrial life sciences researchers, providing an unmatched combination of complete workflow solutions, ranging from cryo-EM structural determination of macromolecular complexes and protein sociology in the native state, to reconstruction of 3D architecture of tissues and cells. Their solutions help researchers unlock the mysteries of underlying protein function and cellular process and bridge the gap between basic science and translational therapeutics. Today's presentation is titled Visualizing Membrane Dynamics by Electron Microscopy, and it's being presented by Shigeki Watanabe from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Shigeki is a neuroscientist recognized for discovering ultra-fast synaptic vesicle recycling mechanisms using novel electron microscopy approaches. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Utah in 2004 and his PhD from the University of Utah in 2013. For his postdoctoral work, he moved to Christian Rosenmund's lab in Berlin, Germany, and studied synaptic transmission and plasticity in mammalian central synapses. In 2016, Shigeki established his laboratory in the Department of Cell Biology at Johns Hopkins University, primarily studying the cellular and molecular basis of synaptic transmission and plasticity. As always, we will have a question and answer session after the presentation. So please type any questions you have into the questions box, which appears on the top right panel of your screen, and I'll put them to Shigeki at the end. Details of how to access the on-demand recording of this webinar will be sent to you by email shortly. So now, over to you, Shigeki, for the presentation.
Okay, so thank you so much for tuning in today. Today I'm going to tell you about how we visualize membrane and protein dynamics with electron microscopy and how we implemented the 3D volume imaging using oxygen plasma beam. And so I'm going to talk about a little bit of science. So my lab is really interested in understanding the cell biology of synaptic transmission. This is the fundamental processes that neurons do to communicate with each other. And so say like when neurons receive some sort of input, say touch, this information is related to the next neuron in the form of electrical signals or action potentials. And then when the action potential arrives at the contact sites between two neurons, this electrical signal turns into the chemical signals, and this is how the neurotransmission actually takes place. And so if you zoom into this region here, at the contact site, this is called synapses, we have these vesicles that contain chemical signals or neurotransmitters. And then when the action potential arrives at the synaptic terminals, the membrane potential changes, and then in response, the voltage-gated calcium channels open, allowing the calcium to come into the synaptic terminals, and then this allows vesicles to fuse. And so let's say that if this is a glutamate molecule, this is going to bind to the glutamate receptor on the postsynaptic side. And then this allows the opening of these receptors, allowing sodium to go in, and then this then generates action potential in the next cell. And so the basic of synaptic transmission is well described, but the molecular details and how this really happens is still quite debated. And so my lab is really interested in understanding how this really happens at the cellular scale, and then also the molecular mechanism of synaptic transmission. And so if you were to actually look at this by electron microscopy, this is actually how it looks like. It's actually quite complicated. And so you can see that these organelles, synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter, they are actually quite tiny. They are only 40 nanometer in diameter, and they contain this neurotransmitter or chemical signals, right? But they are so clustered that with the light microscopy, you cannot actually see individual vesicles and how they actually behave. The only way that you can actually visualize these vesicles by electron microscopy. But the biggest issues with director microscopy is that you cannot actually visualize the their dynamics, because electron micrography is a basically a static image, right? And you cannot actually see any proteins that are supposed to regulate these processes. There are about 3,000 different species of proteins regulating synaptic transmission, but we cannot see any of these proteins. And also with the electron microscopy, we are cutting the tissues so thin, we are cutting at 40 nanometer. And so if you wanted to look at how they actually look like in 3D space, you have to do a lot of reconstruction to actually see this. And so even a question like which vesicles are actually used for neurotransmission, and then where actually they fuse, where do these vesicles actually fuse relative to the receptors? We cannot actually answer these questions by just looking at the electron micrographs. And so in order to actually overcome these issues and then really answer these questions, we came up with a way to visualize membrane protein dynamics in a 3D space. And so first I'm gonna talk about how we visualize membrane dynamics using zapping and freeze technique. And then we also develop a technique to look at protein dynamics. This is called small metal affinity staining of HISTAG or SMASH. And then third, we collaborated with Thermo Fisher to look at the 3D volume of these tissues at the ultra high resolution using oxygen plasma beam. Okay, so let me just tell you about how we actually visualize membrane dynamics. This is called zap and freeze electron microscopy. And so the idea is quite simple. What we wanted to do is to stimulate neuron and freeze tissues at defined time points after stimulation so that we can actually visualize how membrane dynamics, membrane architecture actually changes over time. And so in order to do this, we collaborate with the Leica to actually generate this device that allows us to stimulate neuron and freeze tissues at defined time points. And so we built this device in part by Wayne Davis in Eric Jorgensen lab. And then the way that this actually works is that we have this light sensitive switch, which also has a this also has a capacitor on it. And then when you shine the light onto this switch, the circuit closes, allowing the capacitor to discharge so that you can actually stimulate neurons that's embedded within this space here. And so here is another schematic with the animations. And so when you shine the light for 1 millisecond, this circuit closes, allowing the capacitor to discharge and then allowing neurons to be stimulated for 1 millisecond. And this induces action potential in neurons. And what you do is you freeze tissues at defined time points after the stimulations. And in our case, let's say that we freeze 5 milliseconds after the stimulation. And this is the peak of neurotransmission, as you can see in this diagram. And so just to show you that this technique actually works, what we did was we stimulate neuron and then look at these time points when the neurotransmission is at its peak. And so we are expecting these vesicles to fuse with the plasma membrane and then collapse into the membrane for neurotransmission. And so can we actually capture that moment? And indeed we can. And so here is the image. This is the no stimulation control over here. What you can see is that these vesicles that are docked or waiting at the plasma membrane for calcium to come, calcium signaling to come in. But when you look at 5 milliseconds after the stimulations, you can see that some of these vesicles are actually fusing with the plasma membrane, and some of them are actually already collapsed into the membrane. And so we can actually capture the moment when the neurons are communicating with each other with this technique. But again, this is actually a 2D image. And so you have to do some sort of a 3D serial section reconstructions to really tell where these vesicles are actually fusing in this particular regions. And so we can do that by serial sectioning. This is actually time consuming, but we can definitely do that. And so this is the beginning of the synapses. And then you can see going through this volume, you start seeing fusion event happening, multiple of these fusion pits that are actually found within this active zone, where the active zone is the region where the vesicles fuse. And in fact, in this particular synapses, we saw 11 fusion bits that actually captured in this particular case. And so with the serial sectioning, we can actually see where the vesicles actually fuse. These white circles are the remaining vesicles. This omega figure is the fusion fusing vesicles. And you can see the relationship between the remaining vesicles and then where the vesicles actually fuse in a particular synapses by reconstructions. This is a case for 1.2 millimolar more physiological calcium concentration. We can elevate the calcium concentration to 2 millimolar and then 4 millimolar and then do exactly the same experiment, but you can start seeing more and more vesicles actually fuse within each synapses. And then a lot of these fusion events actually clustered within the synapses. And so this allows us to actually really map where the release takes place in the active zone. So with the zap and freeze technique, we can really visualize membrane dynamics of the synapses. What about the protein dynamics? Where are the proteins? Where are the proteins relative to these fusing vesicles? And so to address this, we came up with a new technique called SMASH, small metal affinity staining of his dye. And so the way that this works is that we tag the protein of interest, in this case, AMPA receptor, or one of the glutamate receptors that you find in the postsynaptic membrane with the his tag, polyhistidine tag. And then because polyhistidine actually has a high affinity to nickel, we can actually conjugate gold particles to the nickel through NTA. And then we can apply this extracellular in an extracellular solution. And then this actually binds the histag proteins. And we can actually visualize where these proteins are by electromicroscopy because gold particles are electrodense. And so with this approach, we can actually, with the SMASH approach, and then we can combine it with the zap and freeze to really visualize the membrane and protein dynamics at the millisecond temporal resolutions. And so just to show you that this technique actually works, here is the histag UA2 AMPA receptor subunit. You can see the gold particles within the postsynaptic density or synaptic cleft in this case. And then, but if you, you were to express a non-histag protein, in this case, we use a halo tag as a control, you can see that there's no gold particles found in the synaptic cleft. And so we can quantify the number of gold particles. You can see that only histag case with the protein with the histag, you can actually see these gold particles accumulating in the synaptic cleft. And so this technique really works. And so with this, what we decided to do is to ask these questions, where are the fusing vesicles relative to the receptors? And so there are two types of glutamate receptors, two more abundant glutamate receptors that you find in these hippocampal neurons. One of them is called AMPA receptor, which has low affinity to glutamate. So they have to be really close to where the vesicles actually fuse in order to be activated. If they are too far away, they cannot be activated. And so this relationship between release sites or fusing vesicles to the receptors actually really matters for neurotransmission. There's another type of glutamate receptor called NMDA receptor. This is actually quite important for plasticity of synaptic transmission, changing the strength of the synaptic connections. And the reason for this is that NMDA receptor actually is different from AMPA receptor in that it also allows calcium to come in into the cell, and the calcium acts as a secondary messenger to activate a lot of downstream molecules. And so NMDA receptor has a higher affinity. Their location was thought to be, it doesn't matter too much to the synaptic transmission. At least that's how people thought about it. But when we started doing this experiment, looking at two different types of receptors, their location was actually quite different. And so in fact, if you do histag on AMPA receptors versus histag on NMDA receptors, their location was actually quite different. And so this was even obvious with the 2D images of these synapses. And you can see that the AMPA receptor seems to localize towards the edge of the synaptic terminals, whereas NMDA receptors seems to concentrate near the center of the synaptic profiles. And we can quantify this, and you can see that their distribution within the postsynaptic density is actually quite different. And so you can see that the NMDA receptors are more clustered towards the center. This is the center of the postsynaptic density. This is towards the edge. And you can see that they are more centrally localized, whereas AMPA receptors are much more edge localized compared to NMDA receptors. But this is actually really 2D profiles. And so we wanted to actually really look at this in 3D and then do a serial section reconstructions of how these receptors are localized. But the problem here is that the gold particles that we used is only 10 nanometer. And we can only physically cut the sections by 40 nanometer thickness. And so you have to be able to cut it much thinner and then have all this resolution that we need to visualize where the peaks are, where the receptors are. And so in order to do this, we actually turn into optical plasma beam imaging with the Thermo Fisher. And so Tveta, my friend, and also a colleague in the field, she's a product manager of this pipeline for doing 3D imaging with the oxygen plasma focused ion beam SEM. And she came talk to me about this new pipeline that allows us to do exactly what I mentioned, which is to do a high resolution imaging with the much more thinner sections. And so this is the Thermo Fisher Hydra using oxygen plasma focus ion beam. And so normally when you do focus ion beam milling to do serial block phase imaging, the way that you do this is to make a little trench and then you have an electron beam and you have a focus ion beam from the angle. And then the way that you do this is that you image the surface of this little trench and then you come in with a focused ion beam to mill away some of the sections. And this is actually quite a slow process. So you have to image, you have to mill, then you can have a new surface, you image, and then mill the sample. And then you do this repeatedly until you have the desired volume. The problem is that, as you can see, the trench is actually quite small, and you can only section so much with this focused ion beam. And so it takes a lot of time, and also you can only have a small volume. And so this has been a big issue with the focused ion beam imaging. But with the oxygen plasma beam, what you can do is actually you can expose a big surface, in this case, 400 by 400 micron surface, and then you can image any of these volume, any of this surface here, and you can actually create a 3D volume in any particular locations within this.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Listen In from Bite Size Bio. To access the visuals of this webinar, please see the episode description for a link to the full presentation.
And this process is actually quite fast. This is an oxygen plasma beam, and then they actually combine this with the spinning of the samples so that you can actually scratch the surface in a way that you can see here. And then you can image any of this surface here. And then the great thing about oxygen plasma beam is that this oxygen actually neutralizes the charges on the surface. So you don't actually have to coat these samples with any heavy metals or carbons in order to actually image them. And so any plastic that you put your specimens in, you can image with this technique. And then another aspect that I should mention here is that you don't actually need to have heavy metal staining. So any tissue that you actually have already in the shell, you can actually put it into this system, and then you can actually get great images. And so I really highly recommend this approach. And so this is actually the inside of the microscope. This is the oxygen plasma beam coming in from the side, and you can scratch the surface, and you can then image with the electrons. And so you cannot really see the beam, but you can imagine how this is really happening in this chamber. And so this is my samples. This is the hippocampal organotypic slices that we sent to Thermo Fisher for imaging. And you can see that how big this volume really is. And then what's nice thing about the one nice thing about this approach is that you can actually see, identify the locations of interest because you are exposing so much surface area. And then you can just identify a region of interest and then say, I want to take images from these locations and then make a 3D volume from those particular locations. And so these are the typical images that we get out of the system. You can see a nice vesicles that I told you about in synapses. And then you can actually really zoom into this volume. And then actually you can see exocytic PIPs using this particular method. Vesicles are clearly seen. And then you can see some other organelles like multivesicular bodies, mitochondria over here. So all of those can be actually visualized with this technique. And so again, we didn't do any special treatment in this particular case. For serial Bruch phase imaging, you typically have to add a lot of heavy metals, but we didn't. And so here we just have 1% osmium and just 0.1% urine acid during a free substitution. And then here we just use epoxy-based resin, nothing special. Something that we already had on the shelf, and we shipped it to Thermo Fisher for imaging. And so the biggest question then is, can we actually really visualize where the receptors are, and then can we actually visualize their locations relative to the fusion events? And so here we can do that. And so we cut the sections every 10 nanometer in this particular case, so that the gold particles won't be overlapping in the next sections. And then you can see where the gold particles are in a particular section as each line indicates. And so here, for example, this particular section had two gold particles, and then you can see where these are relative to each other in a 3D space. And so this is NMDA receptors. And as we saw in the 2D images, their location seems to be quite different. And then in fact, AMPA receptor seems to have two clusters per synapses. And then there's only one cluster of NMDA receptor in each synapse. And then their location is actually quite different. And AMPA receptors are more edge localized, whereas NMDA receptors are really in the center of the synapses. And this is also quantified. As you can see, NMDA receptors are towards the center, whereas AMPA receptors are towards the edge of the postsynaptic density. And so where are the release sites relative to these receptors? Can we actually capture fusing vesicles with the receptors? And yes, we can. And so we combine zap and freeze technique with the SMASH technique to really visualize where the receptors are related to the fusion events. And so here is the images. You can see where the gold particles are. These are the vesicles that are docked at the particular locations. This is a no stimulation control. After stimulation, we can capture fusing vesicles, and you can see where the receptors are relative to these events. And you can see where the NMD receptors, we can do the same. We can see non-stimulation control where we can see these vesicles that are docked at the plasma membrane. But when you look at after the stimulation, you can see a fusion event, but quite distant from the fusing vesicles, you see gold particles of NMD receptors. And so if you compare where these receptors are relative to the fusing events, as predicted from based on the affinity of these receptors to the glutamate, you can see the AMPA receptors are really close to the fusing vesicles. So this is the distance from fusing vesicles or PETs to the each of the gold particles that we see. And so you can see the AMPA receptors are really clustered near the PETs, whereas the NMDA receptors are much, much farther away from where the fusing vesicles are. And so these, from these, we concluded that release sites are aligned with AMPA receptors, but not so much with the NMDA receptors. And so just to summarize, this is what we are thinking, what we think is happening, where we think that there are a bunch of vesicles that are docked at the plasma membrane. And then when you actually stimulate, the calcium comes in, causing the fusion of vesicles. And then in this case, what happens is that those vesicles that are aligned closer to the AMPA receptors actually fuse in response to the calcium influx. And then this activates the AMPA receptors more than NMDA receptors. And so with this technique, we can actually do, we can visualize membrane and protein dynamics, and then we can visualize protein and membrane dynamics in three-dimensional space. And so I just want to end my talk by thanking all the people who actually did the work. This project was led by former graduate students of my lab, Shuori, and then Grant Cusick, with the help from Morgan Chin and Smana, and then Sarah. And then we have a bunch of collaborators for this project, and then all that, this is my funding source for this particular project. And so thank you for listening, and now I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you for that presentation, Shigeki. We will now hear from Ron Kelly, application scientist at Thermo Fisher Scientific.
Thank you, Shigeki, for your excellent presentation today and to the audience for listening. My name is Ron Kelly, and I'm an application scientist with Thermo Fisher Scientific. And I wanted to let you know where you can find out more information about the Hydra. The Hydra can perform volume EM imaging on many sample types, ranging from tissues to proteins, under cryogenic and also room temperature conditions. It can also be used to prepare lamellae for cryotomography. So if you're interested and want to learn more about the Hydra and other volume EM techniques like serial block face imaging or array tomography, you can visit thermofisher.com/volumeEM.
Thanks so much, Shigeki and Ron, for those presentations. We'll be starting the Q&A soon, and if anyone has a question, you can put that in the questions box at the top right of your screen. But before we do that, we've got a few polled questions for the audience. So the first question should be appearing now. Which of the following volume EM techniques do you currently use in your laboratory? So I'll give everyone a few moments to answer that. And I guess in the meantime, we can go on to the first question. So the first question, Shigeki, can your approach with the Hydra microscope benefit connectomics?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the great thing about this Hydra is that you can actually cut more, slices. And then it's going to be much, much bigger volume than how it has been. And so you have enough resolution to resolve connections between neurons. And also you have much, much faster speed for acquisition of images. And so, yeah, this is really optimal for connectomics.
Great, thanks. Do we have the results of the first poll? Great. Oh, that's a good spread of things. Lots of different techniques that people are using. I guess we can move on to the second poll question for the audience in the meantime, and that is, do you currently work with cryo-electron microscopy or tomography? And again, we'll move on with another question. So what other research applications do you see spin mill supporting? And I guess that could be a question for both of you.
Yeah, I can take this first. And then, so, I mean, anything that you want to do looking in 3D volume, but at the special resolution that electron microscopy allows, that's what the Hydro allows. So yeah, any applications that you can think of, if you wanna make a 3D volume, this is probably the way to do it.
Ron, any thoughts?
I think the one of the bigger benefits of this technique is that it sort of bridges the gap from low resolution to high resolution. So it exposes a huge area to survey, and then you can focus in on smaller areas to collect data on. So exploration of a large area and data collection on smaller areas is pretty beneficial for saving time and searching for needles in a haystack. They're a little bit easier to track this way.
Definitely, yeah. Do we have the results of the second poll? Before we move on with that. Lots of people don't yet work with cryo-EM or tomography, but want to, so good to have everyone here and learning new things. We've got a few questions that just came in. Let's read this one. What is the biggest width that you can image with PFIB SEM?
The biggest width, you said?
Yeah.
Field of view is around a millimeter, somewhere around 900 microns.
So around a millimeter, thanks.
Yep.
And another question, I think this one's for Shigeki. Why do you use oxygen but not other plasma species?
Yeah, well, this is probably better answered by Ron, but what oxygen is good for is actually the fact that like they can neutralize the charges on the surface. And so you don't get this artifact, you know, charging artifact, so the plastic doesn't melt or like you have this milling, issues. So that's part of the reason that the oxygen is used. But Ron probably has better insight into this.
Yeah, I think, you pointed out the shining star benefit from oxygen there, but I think you do have other choices for ion species. So why did we choose oxygen? The other ion species have other advantages, like if you wanted to remove large volumes of material faster than with oxygen, you could switch to xenon. Mm-hmm. It turns out for this application, oxygen makes the sample conductive, and it also gives us a smoother cross-section surface, so very polished result. That's a second advantage. So choices, there are advantages with different material types. Maybe we have sputter rates or you get a better result with argon sputtering on when you have different materials mixed in together. In this case, oxygen is the best choice. And yeah, I think Shigeki's application shows it well.
Yeah. Yeah. So we actually covered the next question also, which is how important is oxygen for spin milling of large areas? We talked about that. We've got a question that just came in. Let me just read this quickly. A question about the resolution on the plasma fib stack was written as 5x5x2. Does that mean plasma could mill with a 2 nanometer step?
Yeah, so that's correct. As far as I understand it, you can get down to 2 nanometer. I don't know how practical this is, but in principle, you can.
Great, thanks. And then the last question that just came in, it's currently the last question, unless anything else comes in, is could this zip and freeze device be applied to cryo samples?
Okay, yes and no. So yes, if you just culture your cells on a sapphire, then you can definitely do that. The problem with the TEM grid is that it's electron conductive, and so we cannot apply field stimulation that way. And so with that, you might have to use a different substrate. Still sapphire is a way to do it. Like you can just do, cryofib milling afterwards to, put that into the cryofib machine. Mm-hmm. And then you can then take the lamella to the cryo tomography. So Yes, you can do that, but at the same time, there's some limitations.
Great, thanks. Yeah, we actually had two people asking about cryo applications. So, another question is, what is involved in switching the plasma source, for example, from xenon to oxygen? It's maybe a question for Ron.
Yeah, switching the plasma source is integrated. It's basically you click a drop-down menu and choose which ion species you want. It's like a 5 minute, I think the spec is 10 minutes, but it's usually quicker than that to change. And it's all automated. So it's just a software click.
Great. Amazing. That sounds easy. And again, this is currently the last question. They're just coming in as I ask them. So it's really hard to say that whether it's really the last, but what grid types do you use to obtain such a large sample area?
This is for Ron, I think. I mean, technically, you don't actually use grids in this. You are just putting the samples onto a stab for SEM, and then you are putting it into the SEM. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the samples that I typically send to Thermo Fisher in this particular case is it's basically a whole block. It's a big, you know, block face that I just sent, and then they will just do a meeting. So you are technically just using a stab in this case.
And another good question from Roberto following that is, what are the benefits of FIB versus other serial imaging techniques? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Yeah, so I would say it's more automated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so any serial imaging technique otherwise is a little bit harder. Array tomography may be another way to do it, but there's also, you know, benefits and disadvantage in that as well. So the film meeting with oxygen plasma, I think it's a good compromise. You have a larger volume, and then it's easy of use. So yeah.
Yep, I would add, well, Shigeki showed 2 nanometer slice thickness. So you have some controls down to very thin slices if needed. That's one. And also it exposes a really large surface area. So I don't know, 800 microns in diameter is possible. So you can explore large volumes, larger areas.
Yeah, great. Thanks. And the next question is, how specific is the nanogold labeling? Did you try the same setting without HISTag?
Yeah, yes. So we've done a control experiment. I think I've shown this control experiment where we add the halo tag instead of HISTag, and then we basically essentially see no background staining. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't occlude, you know, some background staining because there are enough native proteins that contain polyhistidine in sequence. And so you do get a little bit of backgrounds that way. Mm-hmm. But when we looked at, you know, this particular location within the synapses, we actually did not see any staining, background staining. And so, yeah, depends on, yeah, where you look at.
Great. Thanks. So I think we've worked our way through all of the questions. There were quite a lot of questions, so it was great. One thing to note is if you would like to find out more information about Thermo Fisher volume electron microscopy, like the Hydrec cryoplasma FIB microscope, or speak to an expert, please visit thermofisher.com/VEM. And I think that brings us to the end of our webinar today. So thank you again, Shigeki, for a very illuminating presentation. And thank you, Ron, for providing more information. And of course, thanks to our sponsor, Thermo Fisher. And finally, thanks to you, the audience, for taking the time to attend and listen in. So until next time, good luck in your research and goodbye from all of us at Thermo Fisher and Bitesize Bio.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Listen In from Bitesize Bio. To view the full presentation of this webinar or to browse the Listen In series, please see the episode description for links.
Finding the right mentor can make all the difference in your research journey. But what if you don't have one? Look no further than Mentors at Your Benchside, the podcast that offers curated advice from experienced researchers on lab skills, techniques, and career progression. With short, easy-to-access episodes, you can get the help you need to succeed in the lab. Visit bitesizebio.com/podcasts or search for Mentors at Your Benchside in your podcast app to subscribe and get help and advice from seasoned scientists.